Welcome to minute 67 of season 8 of Movie Run Minute, the daily podcast where we foobar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is a professor of modern history from Loughborough University, Sam Edwards. Welcome back to the show, Sam.
Thanks so much for having me back, Rob.
Yeah. This has been such a fascinating, group of days that we've been talking about this stuff here. I'm learning so much. I'm learning from the historical perspective. I hope you're learning from a movie making perspective. Something I don't know.
Absolutely, am. I'm learning all the time.
Hey, well, that's what we all do in life. That's the way it works.
Every day's a school day.
That's right. But as long as there's no tests, we're good. So minute 67 begins with a shot of Wade continuing to copy the letter as Mike and Miller continue their conversation, and ends with Mike trying to rationalize things. So we talked a little bit about this yesterday at the end of the minute we're hearing the conversation between Mike and Miller, but we're seeing Wade doing something else. Wade is actually writing. He's rewriting the letter to Caparzo's parents. Mm-hmm. So we can see some of it in the very beginning of this movie. We see that he copies the address and all that stuff, and then in this scene it says, "Dear Mom and Dad, received your letter." And the thing that surprises me about this whole thing, again, he's trying to do a favor for his friend and stuff like that, but by the time his parents get this letter, okay, first of all, Caparzo's parents are going to know that he already, didn't make it. But the handwriting is completely different. We see that Wade is writing it in block letters when Caparzo wrote his letter in script. Mm-hmm. So, and again, by the time that Caparzo's parents are going to get this, it's going to be a long time afterwards. I understand the perspective. Okay, your son unfortunately was killed in Normandy, and look, you can actually see his final thoughts to you. From that perspective, I agree with that. But I guess they didn't bring in handwriting analysis and stuff like that. Back then. I understand the purpose of this. But it's just it's an interesting back then they didn't have cell phone cameras where you can just take a picture and find a way to use some sort of program to take out the redness from the blood and stuff like that.
I think it's really interesting for what you just said there about how, as a historian, this is these are what we're seeing here. Is one of the key types of historical source kind of being made that the historians have used so much in trying to understand the experience of combat, the experience of World War II, what it was like for the soldiers, because they're letter writers, right? And it's the same in the First World War as well, but Second World War, definitely, soldiers, British, American, Canadian, they're letter writers. They write home. The mail is incredibly important. You're getting the mail is a kind of a real morale thing. And so kind of correspondence, writing letters home, receiving letters from home, it's kind of integral to how people endured and experienced and, survived World War II, for those that did survive.
Right. But from the other perspective, we talked about this yesterday, about the censor, the information that they were able to give over was limited. My assumption is that the soldiers learned, how to phrase things, and maybe that's one of the reasons why it's so fascinating for you to research this information to try to understand, what's being written between the lines, as opposed what is being said there. Anyone who's familiar with the miniseries The Pacific, so that was based a lot on letters also. Bob Leckie, he eventually, he was writing letters all the time, and that's one of the things that, brought him to eventually publish his book. Something on my helmet. Can't remember the full name of
Yeah.
of the book right now. It is that exact thing. It's looking at the various stuff that of what he said to his not even girlfriend, who became his wife. Helmet for my pillow. That was the name of it.
There you
There you go.
Yeah, it's one of the fascinating things about letters, about being a historian, right? Full stop, right? It's trying to find out what was done, thought, felt, experienced in the past, and sometimes you get it kind of nice and clear, but sometimes it's less than straightforward. And one of the challenges, one of the fun bits, is to, as you say, kind of read between the lines. What's actually being said here? And there was a style, there was a way. Just one. So one of the great things about being a historian is kind of using these types of sources, these materials, and sometimes you can sort of read these letters and they tell you exactly what people are thinking and feeling, right? But that's relatively rare. Actually, what you get are hints. But you have to read between the lines, as you say. You have to figure out, what is this person actually trying to communicate and say here? Because especially soldiers writing letters home in both the world wars, they know their stuff's going to be checked, officers going to review and censor, and they can't reveal too much. So there's something quite fascinating in reading through how they describe their experiences and what they're enduring to the loved ones back home, to the folks back home.
Right. How did they censor it? Were they just like redacting stuff?
It varied from military to military. Sometimes, there's plenty of examples in British military of things, lines being struck through. Often it was just kind of a learning process, right?
No, but
Because
couldn't you then take it
they
and hold it up to the light to try and figure out what was written below
Do you know what? Probably, if you're really dedicated. But eventually it becomes a learning thing that they learn how to write letters back home and what they can say and what they can't say.
I mean, is it, were soldiers at this time, did they have to go through like I don't know if course is the right word. Did they have to go through a lecture explaining to them what they're allowed to talk about and what they're not allowed to talk about? Like, you can't say where you are, I'm assuming. You can't
There
say
would have
how many
been
men you are. You can't say what your objective
exactly.
is, things like that.
Yeah, there was lots of instruction, lots of guidance from officers, but also from the Allied military in the alliance. There was a propaganda campaign. There were kind of posters and all sorts of kind of communication that filtered their way down to the troops and to civilians, and back home about. Keeping stern, keeping mum, as the phrase was in Britain, as in, don't share secrets, don't talk to strangers, don't tell people about what's happening in the war, because you don't know who you're talking to. So there's a whole kind of campaign of a kind of a secrecy around the Allied war effort to ensure that not too much is given away.
Interesting. Ah, you mean so like parents also had to know what they could say?
Yeah, I mean, on both home fronts, and especially in Britain from 1939, there are whole kind of propaganda campaigns to encourage people not to kind of share gossip, not to talk to people they don't know. Absolutely, if you're in the military, not to reveal where you're posted, what you're doing. A whole series of propaganda campaigns around this to
Right, no,
ensure that.
that I completely understand. I meant from a letter writing perspective. Carpaccio's parents get a letter. How are they supposed to? I mean, like, what are they going to say that's going to give away, information about New York?
In their
They
direction,
could ask
it's less of an
questions.
issue. Yeah,
Exactly.
yeah,
They
yeah.
could ask questions, but
They just might not get answers. Yeah, yeah.
hey,
Yeah.
where are you these days? What are you
Yeah,
doing?
yeah, yeah. Well, I can't say. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Interesting. Okay, so the conversation between Horvath and Miller was all about Vecchio, and Horvath then goes, he got shot in the foot once, didn't he, when he was walking on his hands, which makes you wonder why someone is walking on his hands in a combat situation, but okay.
It's like a moment of light relief in the film, because either side of it there's difficult stuff, and there's just this moment of light relief, but it's melancholic as well, because as we then learn, and the person they're fondly remembering here. Yeah.
And then Miller goes, yeah, he could walk faster on his hands. He could run faster on his hands than, and then he goes, Vecchio. Yeah. Caparzo. You see, when you end up killing one of your men, you tell yourself it happens. So you could save the lives of two or three or 10 others, maybe 100 others. Do you know how many men I've lost under my command? Mike just looks at him and goes, How many? 94. But that means I've saved the lives of 10. And then he gets cut off with what he's trying to say here. But it's very interesting the way that this whole speech comes across. You know, again, it goes back to the idea that, okay, here they're having this little lull in their campaign, and they have time to reflect and think about it and stuff like that. And I think one of the things they're trying to show here is they're trying to hint to the different to the humanity of Miller.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, something that we're not sure about up until now, because, you know, if you've never seen this movie and you're hearing this conversation, you might think that he's just this, you know, gung-ho officer. You don't know what his background is or anything like that. So it's just very interesting to give us this perspective.
Yeah, as you say, it's kind of the humanity of the character, and it's also telling us something about the burden of command, right? The burden of leadership, which then further, you know, sort of further develops our understanding of what we're seeing with his shaking hand. This is kind of the psychic toll of combat and of leadership in combat, of having to make these impossible decisions where whatever you do, it might not be right, and whatever you do, it might end in the death of those that you're commanding. So it's kind of, yeah, his humanity and the burden that he's carrying and trying to carry as well as he can.
And I think the way that he says this also says a lot about it. He says, when you end up killing one of your men.
Yeah.
You know,
a sense of personal culpability. It's his fault. It's his responsibility.
Yeah. That's right. And I mean, we all saw what happened with Caparzo. Miller was doing his best to try to stop Caparzo from what he was trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't see, you know, I don't think anybody who's watching the movie will say that Miller is in any way, shape, or form culpable for the fact that, you know, that Caparzo was killed. Caparzo didn't listen to him.
Yeah, and so it's almost suggestive of what we'll later, I think it's later, isn't it, in the film, what we later learn about his past and his background and his previous career. Spoiler alert.
You can discuss spoilers. It's fine. Again, the assumption is that anyone who's listening to this has watched the movie, and if you haven't, once again, stop listening right now. Go watch the movie and then come back and continue to listen.
Absolutely. So what we got a little glimpse of there is of Miller, not just as commander and warrior, but Miller as teacher, right? And that sense that he has this kind of, he feels this deep personal responsibility to his soldiers, as though they're not entirely different from the students that he was teaching back home, you know, the kids that he was teaching back home, that sense of almost kind of parental responsibility for them. And so their death is not the fault of the enemy, it's his responsibility. I made the decision and it killed this guy or this guy. And to that extent, as you were saying a moment ago, it gives us a very different type of war hero, right? This is not the gung-ho guy. This is a humane, sensitive former teacher who has some kind of deep sense of responsibility to the men he commands, and as a result of all of that is kind of enduring now this kind of psychic torment and this trauma, which is given to us in the shaking of the hand.
Right. And I think it also goes to the fact of, you know, as you alluded to, he looks at his men as if he's their father, you know, and he's the one, I mean, again, he's the one who chose who's coming with them.
Yeah.
You know, we saw it during the initial scenes in this movie where he's deciding which men he's sending, you know, across, you know, and the, you know, the guys that all seem to get shot, you know, as they're trying to move to the next or beyond the next barrier, you know, on the beach, you know, and he's saying, okay, you go there, you go there, you go there. That's obviously the job of a military commander to make the decision of sending, you know, your troops. You don't know whether you're sending them to their death or not, but you know, the idea that he chose that he's taking Caparzo here, maybe that's what he's looking at it from that perspective. Yeah. He's saying, okay, I sent Caparzo. I chose to take Caparzo with us. So therefore,
it's on me.
Yeah. Which is interesting.
Yeah. It makes me think, this is a sort of a more recent film. You'll probably know the date of this, but it makes me think of a similar scene now, at least in Battle Los Angeles, that kind of alien invasion film.
I think there's 2012, maybe 2013.
2012. And there's a really powerful moment with Aaron Eckhart's character. He's the grizzled sergeant, the grizzled staff sergeant, and he's sort of talking about the burden of command. Yeah, I could go left, I could go right, and it didn't matter. It was all bad. And there's kind of a little bit of a similarity there, in that sort of that the impossibility of making the right decision.
Right. It's 2011. I was only off by 1 year. Yeah, there you go.
There you go. That's good. That's what
I was close. I was in the right decade. How's that? Right. So, I mean, he talks here a little bit about the fact that Vecchio was walking on his hands and stuff like that. So do you have any idea about some of the world records hand walking?
Maybe. This is another one of your pop quizzes, right?
Yes, it is.
Got me again.
Yes, it is. That.
Yeah, go on, tell me. Go on, tell me about world records.
Okay, so the fastest anyone has been able to walk 20 meters walking on their hands is 4.78 seconds. And it was done on the 15th of February, 2021. And it was done by a man named Zion Clark, who himself was born without legs. He has a rare genetic disorder called caudal regression syndrome. And, he was able to, that's just amazing that within 5 seconds he could walk on his hands 20 meters. The longest distance that someone was able to walk on their hands was 1,400 kilometers, which is 870 miles.
Wow!
An Austrian named Johann Herliger did it in 55 daily 10-hour stints as he was walking from Vienna to Paris, and he did this in 1900. And he averaged 2.54 kilometers every hour, which is 1.57 miles.
The turn of the century, early 1900s, these kind of feats of endurance, it was a big thing of this age, of doing these feats of endurance, of long distance walking, distance running. And now we learn of long distance walking on your hands. Well,
yeah. I mean, again, it's probably, because they didn't have social media at the time, so they were bored. Yeah,
that's one way of looking at it.
I don't know. I can't imagine wanting to get that record. I don't know. To walk 1,400 kilometers, just on my hands. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a real commitment. That is, yeah.
Yes, that really is. So yeah, I don't know. and I mean it's. This whole conversation is just great. The way that the two of them, or mostly Miller, is showing how much he cares for his men. The fact that he remembers that his 94 men have been killed under his command, that in itself is very impressive. Because he must be keeping a list somewhere.
Yeah. And it's clear that from the conversation, from that, the fact that he remembers that as well, that one of the ways in which he's trying to rationalize his responsibility is to kind of weigh up the math of it all, right? Yeah, I've lost this many, but as he goes on to say in the next bit of the scene, but in doing so, I've saved more, right? I've saved more though, and I've saved 10 times more. If I've lost that many, I must have saved 10 times more. That's the way he's trying to rationalize to himself
he's trying to justify his actions, and we can hear from his voice, which again shows how great of an actor Tom Hanks is, and how great of a director Spielberg is by the way he directs this scene, is to make us really believe that this character is distraught about the idea that the life of all his men is in his hands, and he's doing it in order to save 2, 3, 10 times as many, that type of thing.
Yeah.
They make him, we're able to sympathize with him.
Yeah. And as you say, which is revealing of how Spielberg handles the scene, but as you rightly say, it's also kind of Hanks's brilliance as actor, because just the emotional range there, that he's gone from kind of shaking hands to laughing, and it's genuine laughter. It's not kind of forced or anything like that. It's, you know, about, you know, as he fondly remembers Vecchia, right through to him kind of working through the math of the decisions he's having to make. It's just, and all to do all of that in a couple of minutes, it's like, wow.
Yeah, it really is. It's quite amazing. And I mean, that's the way that this minute ends. Is there anything else you want to say about this minute?
The only other thing I was going to say was it's worth kind of thinking about where this all happens. And it's in a kind of, you know, a bomb damaged, war damaged church. And of course, before we've seen them as they head into the village itself and the damage that it's experienced. And so we're given a sense here of how Normandy and the people of Normandy are kind of experiencing this invasion as well. Again, it will have massive, it'll produce massive devastation and destructions through Norman towns and villages as the Allies fight to win their liberty. So just get a little bit of a sense of that there with them being in this battle damaged church as a place of sanctuary. It's the sanctuary for them, but it itself has also experienced war.
Right. I mean, they're supposed to be in Vierville, right?
That's right.
Have you ever been to Vierville in your travels?
I have been to Vierville.
In your travels as a 15-year-old on your own in Normandy?
I have. I think probably the first time I went was as a 15-year-old in the mid-1990s. Yes, so I've been to Vierville. Nice little village.
No, and you didn't find a bombed-out church that you could have meaningful conversations in?
I did not. I found the church, though. I found the church. The church is there. Yeah.
Do you remember if it looks the way that they have it set up here?
I'm trying to remember now. And I don't want to get it wrong because your listeners will correct me if I'm wrong. But certainly, you know, one of the stories of post-war Normandy is the reconstruction of Norman towns and villages. And a part of that was the reconstruction of some of the churches in some of these places. Some survived, you know, famously the church in St. Mirrenglies with the paratrooper that is caught on it, that famous scene in Longest mm-hmm. Day, that survives. Yeah. Others that are closer to the invasion beaches, those suffer real damage. And so there's a massive program of post-war reconstruction in Normandy to kind of restore these towns and villages.
Right. Oh, wow. Very cool. All right. So every Tuesday, we have a segment called Tom Hanks Tuesday, where my guests will discuss their top five Tom Hanks performances. Once again, thank you very much for agreeing to partake in the top fives.
Yep.
So once again, why don't you start off with your number five and work your way up?
So for number five, and right, first up, this is so difficult, right? Because there are so many great films here, but I've gone for number five, 2016's Sully, which is the story of an airline pilot who saves all of his passengers through a feat of extraordinary flying, landing his aircraft on the Hudson. So this is based on a real life story. And it also then explores the trials and tribulations that he goes through in its aftermath as he seeks to prove that he made the right call in an impossible circumstance. So again, picking up on that and that conversation we've just been having there about, you know, impossible decisions. Sully, 2016. A great film.
Okay. Number four.
Number four. Given that you and I are having this conversation in the in December, I thought for number four, I'd go for possibly one that people wouldn't instantly go for, but I'm going to say it nonetheless. I'm going to go Polar Express, 2004, in which Tom Hanks is the train guard mm-hmm. on the Polar Express as it's working its way through wherever it is, North Pole. So yeah, I thought something for December, Polar Express.
Okay, number three.
Number three, I'm going to go for Road to Perdition, 2002, with Tom Hanks acting out of type a little bit here, because he often plays that sort of warm, likable everyman, and here Road to Perdition, there are hints of that, but a much harder character as well. This is Tom Hanks's gangster and the story of his road to perdition as he seeks to make a better future for his son.
Okay, number two.
Number two, I'm going to say 2000's Castaway, where, as the title suggests, and Tom Hanks plays a guy cast away on an island, you know, in a as a his plane crashes, he's washed up on an island, And we know at the very end he finds safety and he's saved. But the bulk of the film is extraordinary because it's just Tom Hanks and is it a basketball or a volleyball?
Wilson.
Tom Hanks and Wilson. but the idea of just a single actor, carrying a story like that and holding the camera like that, and without anyone to bounce off of in terms of delivering lines other than Wilson the volleyball, I think just another extraordinary bit of acting.
Oh, wow. Okay. And you're number one.
Come on. There's no surprises here, right? Let's go Saving Private Ryan. Number one, Saving Private Ryan, 1998. For the reasons that you and I have been talking about here, that this is on one level, Hanks giving one of his great everyman performances, but in doing so, he's doing something really quite interesting because he's war hero. He's the captain. He's the central and part of the story here. But this is a very different type of war hero handled so brilliantly by Tom Hanks.
All right, excellent. Thank you very much for that list. Saving Private Ryan doesn't have to be number one on every one of your lists.
Oh, yes, it does. Yes, it does.
Okay, I said it doesn't have to be. The fact that it is great. Also, I will give a spoiler to anyone who's waiting, to hear my list at the end of the season. Saving Private Ryan is not number one in every single category.
Outrageous.
All right. So would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
So you can find me online at www.runninghistorian.com or you can track me down on X at historian_Sam.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. You can send me an email to moviearoundminute@movierob.net or you can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. So until tomorrow. Earn this.
Earn this.